Hello, and welcome to Micropod, your small but perfectly formed podcast. I'm Nancy Mendoza, and today's show is an open access special. If you belong to a learned society, it's important to be able to view current quality research. The Society for Applied Microbiology, for example, works with our commercial partner Wiley in publishing 5 applied microbiology journals. Because a society or institution pays a subscription fee, traditionally people accessed scientific articles through an institutional library. But as the Society for Applied Microbiology's chief executive Phil Wheat explains, this system doesn't work for everyone, and the publishing landscape is changing.
One of the downsides of that model is that, of course, there's a whole raft of people, industrial people as an example, the working industry that would like access to the recent research findings, some countries where they cannot afford that subscription payment to the publishers. It means that a lot of research is behind firewalls. It means that you can't access that research, you can't access the latest paper on a whole raft of scientific research, including important medical research, for instance, latest therapies, etc., latest research in those areas. So it means that a lot of people cannot access it. It also means that there is some research, and quite a bit of research, in fact, that is publicly funded by you and me as taxpayers, that ends up in a journal that has a firewall that is not immediately available. So the public, in fact, have paid for that research and ultimately paid for the findings of that research, but then the public are denied access to that research until much later, often a period of as much as 3 years.
So we're looking at changing that method of publishing to make research more freely available to people. What's involved in open access publication?
Open access publication really means that it is freely available to the public at the point of publication. And in the main, there are two ways that in recent years, in two models that have actually been described of being able to do this. One is called the green open access model, which means that nobody actually pays. It is just put on the internet and it would be freely available. I think it's now generally accepted that the production and the standardisation and the quality aspect of scientific publications and articles in general, not just science but other articles, there are considerable costs. So it's difficult to see how the green open access model would actually work in practice. The one that the UK seems to be moving towards and accepting is something called the gold open access. And gold open access is where, again, the article would be freely available at the point of publication, but the costs of producing that article and the costs to the publisher, etc., and the whole process would be met by the author paying a fee for that article to be freely available as soon as it's published. That, in my view, is a more sustainable economic model than the green open access model.
Learned societies are more often than not also publishers of research. Clearly there's a call for open access to increase the accessibility of the outputs of research to all people. But that means changing the economic model. These are important funding streams for learned societies. Can it work?
Certainly the gold open access model can work, provided that the fee chargeable to the author covers the costs of producing the article. I think it comes down to the fact of market forces may, though, lower that author fee. Many learned societies do rely on the income generated substantially for the running of the societies and delivering the aims and objectives, the charitable aims and objectives of the society. And the Society for Applied Microbiology is no different to many learned societies. Our income from our publishing activities, we do operate and deliver education and training for microbiologists, offer grants, etc. And we would not be able to do that as much if the income from the journals was substantially reduced. And I think that's the worry. And I think learned societies have to learn to develop other income streams, look at what their other options are should income from the journal start to significantly decrease.
Phil Wheat. So let's hear the view from an established life sciences publisher. Biomed Central publishes 257 peer-reviewed open access journals. So I asked publishing director Deborah Kahn what she thinks is the greatest advantage to having open access published data.
The fact that anyone can take that content, can verify it, can build on it, can mine it for more information, it accelerates research.
And what are the greatest challenges in open access publishing?
We're still in a transition phase, and so there is a big challenge for libraries and institutions and publishers about how the funding goes from totally funding subscription publishing towards maybe partly funding open access. So how the funds are managed is quite a big challenge. The knowledge about open access and the misinformation that is out there about open access is quite a big challenge in terms of ensuring that people actually understand what it is and what the benefits are is a challenge. There are some organisations that are taking advantage of the fact that it's a pay-to-publish model and behaving inappropriately. They've been dubbed predatory publishers, and ensuring that they're properly dealt with and regulated and don't get the people publishing with them is one of the big challenges at the moment as well.
Biomed Central works with a number of learned societies like the Society for Applied Microbiology. Do you think there are any specific challenges or opportunities for learned societies in open access publishing?
Definitely. We find that the smaller societies, the societies who have their own small number of journals, who are getting squeezed out of libraries because of pressure on library budgets, and therefore they're not getting the visibility they need because they don't have enough subscriptions, find that quite often open access is a way to make themselves more visible to the research community worldwide. That can increase the impact of their research. One of the ways that shows itself is through increasing impact factors, but also just people knowing more about them and knowing what they're doing. And so we have more than 50 societies working with us, and we found that that is the main reason that they come to us, is that they want their research to be available, to be visible, they want their impact factors to increase, they want more people to join their societies, and those are the things that they're finding are happening.
There have been some criticisms of open access publishing. Some people have suggested that scientists are not necessarily motivated to do the really hard experiments, to go the extra mile that they would go for a Nature paper or a science paper to publish in an open access journal. Do you think there's any truth in that?
I don't know what that would be based on. There are many open access journals now which are at the very top of their categories in the Journal Citation Report that have very, very high impact, which are, you know, people compete to get into as much as they would compete to get into any of the main journals in their field. Open access journals are, in the same way as subscription journals, they have varieties of different types of thresholds and peer review, and some of them are, you know, the best journals in their field. Some of them choose to be inclusive. Some of them may not have the best editors-in-chief or the best editorial policies, just as subscription journals. So the business model does not change the way that the journal is run. It's just the way that the journal is financed.
As more journals become open access, I asked Jennifer McLennan from open access publisher eLife if it will change the measures currently used to assess the quality of a journal and its research.
Absolutely. Open access and making material, first of all, openly available online, but in a way that allows readers and users to use it and build upon it without restriction helps it to carry farther. Plus, we have, with technology, web technology, the ability to measure scientific contributions at the article level. So we no longer need to use the name of the journal, the brand of the journal, or the impact factor of the journal as a proxy for the quality of the individual's work.
I wonder then whether, you know, we're almost on the verge of an era where journals kind of cease to matter so much, and what's really important is the way that scientists are sharing information among each other.
I think you're absolutely right. That's the direction that we're headed in. That's indicated by a couple different things. One is that we understand from our users that to find an article, they just go to Google or they go to PubMed Central, and they're hitting the papers at the article level. They're not going through the journal homepages. They're not bothering, you know, with the homepage of the journal. They're just going straight to the article itself. What's more is article level metrics are available, and they're tracking activity at that level. So if you want to see how great an individual paper is, you can see how many times has it been shared, how many times has it been cited, how many times has it been blogged about or written up in the media or tweeted. So when a scientist goes in through Google Scholar, goes in through PubMed Central, and they're not sure, they're looking for measures to gauge the success of this individual study, they may not be familiar with the names or the name of the journal, they can look at the article level metrics and say, wow, thousands of people were interested in this paper in that month.
So will eLife be processing papers in this way? Will eLife be advertising the article level metrics of research that you guys are publishing?
Absolutely, and we already are. We have a very qualified, experienced team with article level metrics, people with very high ambitions. Ian Mulvaney is our head of technology from Mendeley before eLife, and Mark Patterson came to us from PLOS. So these are the pioneers of article level metrics, and we have great, great visions for what we can do at that level, and do have a modest suite of reports going on right now.
It sounds like with open access and with eLife in particular, the internet, the semantic web, the ability to organize this information in a way that makes it available to people is really key. I wonder how much the availability of this technology has really driven the move to open access and this kind of democratization of data and knowledge.
I'd say that the technology and the expansion of the web, even in the late 90s, has highlighted the opportunity and the need to get important information out there. So if we have the opportunity to instantly make key discoveries available to everyone in the world to read and use and build upon, why wouldn't we? Isn't it a disservice to everyone, to science, to society, to policymakers, to people trying to find the cure for key diseases? Isn't it a disservice to them to lock that information away where they can't get access to it? So the first and basic premise of open access is not just that it's freely available online, but that the rights to use that material are there. So it says the open access is tied to a Creative Commons license or a license synonymous with the terms of Creative Commons that say you are free to use, reuse, and build upon and take this information farther and to incorporate it into your own work and come up with something new. So technology really shines a light on the need to do that, the opportunity to do that, but it's the technical and legal constraints of open access that make it possible. It's a nice harmony, isn't it?
eLife is competing with Nature and Science and Cell on the kind of highest strata of life sciences publishing. What is it that gives eLife that kind of level of prestige that allows it to compete with those titles?
First, it's our backing. We have the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, the Max Planck Society, and the Wellcome Trust have come together to create eLife, and each of those organizations signals excellence in science. The second is the editorial team. behind eLife, which drives the whole process. eLife is completely researcher-driven, so they devise the policies and the processes, and they pick all the papers that go into the journal. And third are the papers that we publish. eLife has over 150 papers online now, and you need only read them to see that they match the quality of Cell, Nature and Science.
There's no doubt there's been a big change in publishing within a short space of time. But these changes no longer worry Phil Wheat.
When I first came into the role 9 years ago, open access was on the agenda. And it was pretty scary at the time. You did think that the income would all of a sudden disappear. In reality, and I think my philosophy in quite a number of things, is that I don't think with open access it'll be a revolution. I don't think it'll be a revolution whereby it'll be an overnight change. I think it'll be more of an evolutionary process whereby over a number of years the income will actually, in all probability, decrease. And I think evolutionary process also means that the society, if it's got its business processes sorted out and is adaptive and will be able to adapt to that change in income level. So I wouldn't go as far to say as that I'm not worried. I am concerned, and I think you shouldn't just ignore the potential changes that are there. And I think the other thing to add is that the UK is a leading light in publishing, scientific publishing, and the UK and UK PLC is very fortunate in that if you look at the number of people that are employed associated with journal publications and learned societies, that is a considerable employer. And also it's a considerable export success, because I don't know exactly the figures, but I would say it's many millions of pounds that UK PLC earn from publishing activities, and those publishing activities are very, very much global. It's a worldwide trade. It's a major, major plus for the UK PLC. And one of the big reasons this is the case for UK PLC is also, of course, we're fortunate in that we do speak English, and English is the global scientific language.
I went to a conference a few years ago, and there was a session on the future of publishing, and somebody suggested that we should start publishing in Latin. And I'd say that would be far more of a revolution than open access ever would be.
I agree. As I say, my key way of looking at open access is it's an evolving situation. And I think as learned societies, we need to make sure that policymakers in general understand where learned societies fit into the overall jigsaw puzzle, which is open access publishing in general. And I think it's needed for the learned societies to make sure there is a common voice which actually does make sure policymakers understand the importance of learned societies, not just for publishing, but importance of learned societies, full stop. And in terms of life sciences, where the Society for Applied Microbiology sits under, personally, I think that's where the Society of Biology, and we are a member organisation of the Society of Biology, does have a very important role to play.
Phil Wheat, ending our Micropod Open Access special. Thanks for joining us.